and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
All right, good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Folks, it's all going to be different soon. We are on indictment watch, my friends, and there's big news today. Good morning, Mark Riley. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks a lot, Mark Maron.
You were down south, my friend. How was that? Frightening?
No, actually, it wasn't. It's interesting because there's such contrasts. Asheville, North Carolina, shout out to our affiliate WPEK, 880 AM in Asheville, North Carolina. Asheville is a very interesting place, man, because it's not, I guess, as redneck, certainly as I thought it was going to be. Whenever I go south, I get tense.
It's like the San Francisco of the south, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, downtown Asheville looks a little bit like Woodstock. You know, they got art galleries. They had a big Jewish festival that was going on there. It was an incredible, it was a really interesting experience. And, you know, every time I hear, you know, a southern accent, I get nervous. But everybody was so nice and so cordial. I mean, we went to eat at this restaurant. Everybody, hi, how y'all doing? Come on in, sit down.
I mean, I get nervous, too, with that.
Yeah,
I get a little nervous with that myself. But my shrink vacations in Asheville says it's a great place.
Right? Oh, yeah.
It's a real hipster hang.
It's a hipster hang, and they got this place, the Biltmore Estate, which is unbelievable.
But you said that the radio not so great down there.
Well, no. Other than our affiliate, WPEK, you get nonstop, you know, Hillary is the Antichrist, you know, don't let the liberals take away Christmas. I mean, it was the whole nine yards. It was unbelievable. I'm not making this up. This is actually stuff I heard when I was down there.
Don't let the liberals take away Christmas. Isn't that a new holiday season cartoon that's going to be
I think it's a new CD that's coming out.
Maybe, all right.
What is that, Prussian Blondes? Or whatever? Maybe they're doing it.
That's probably right. So here we go. According to the New York Times today, my friends, notes of Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose identity is the heart of the leak investigation, from...
Who?
Dick Cheney, ladies and gentlemen. Dick Cheney. Weeks before her identity became public in July 2003, there was a conversation between Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney on June 12, 2003. This means, folks, among other things, that Scooter Libby may have perjured himself because he told the grand jury that he heard about Plame's identity from journalists. And it might, journalists.
Yeah.
It might mean that Cheney lied to Fitzgerald under oath as well last year. So that means this could be big news.
What? Yeah, and see, what's interesting about this, Mark, is that that date, June 12, 2003, the Washington Post put out a front-page story that said an American diplomat, who they did not name but turned out later to be Joe Wilson, had gone to Niger to investigate the Yellow Cake claim and found that it was not corroborated by any of the evidence. So in other words, the Washington Post prints this story, and suddenly Libby and Cheney are talking about Joe Wilson.
Right. So now apparently the notes do not show that Cheney knew the name of Joe Wilson's wife necessarily, but they show that Cheney knew and told Libby that Plame worked for the CIA and that she helped arrange her husband's trip. Cheney testified to Fitzgerald under oath last year. It's not clear what he testified, but this raises the possibility he may have lied to at least Fitzgerald under oath. This explains why Fitzgerald waged a long legal battle to obtain the testimony of reporters who were known to have talked to Libby. Of course, we know the reporters involved, Judith Miller, Matthew Cooper, and you were bringing it up earlier today to me, Riley, that there's a third source that we still don't know the name of.
That's right. We still do not know who told Robert Novak Valerie Plame's name, because it was not someone inside the White House, at least according to Robert Novak. But this is some very, very smoking gun stuff on a lot of levels for a lot of reasons. It says, first of all, that the whole frame, and I could, you know, when this first came out, I could never figure this out. The frame of Valerie Plame lobbying or somehow assigning her husband to this mission. Now we know where it came from. It came from the mouth of Dick Cheney.
Well, that's it. You know, the bottom line is that Cheney is now the suspected ringleader, and he and his neocon cohorts put the White House Iraq group together to dupe the American people with skewed intelligence into going into a war that was based on lies. And he has made the world a dangerous place, a more dangerous place, and he is personally responsible, I think, for killing almost 2,000 American soldiers and thousands of Iraqi civilians. This is the bottom line. bottom line on this thing, and we've suspected this all along. And what, also, as I was talking about yesterday when you weren't here, Riley, what's interesting is just how, to what degree these guys went to protect Dick Cheney. And the assumption is like, well, Bush knew. You know what? Maybe he didn't know, because it's been rumored in the last couple weeks that he's been bitter, he's been snapping, he's been angry at Andrew Carr, to Karl Rove, yeah, at Dick Cheney, for keeping him out of the loop. So this, on top of everything else, goes to show just what a powerless, ineffectual leader George Bush really is when it comes to the hands-on machinations of his own government.
Well, see, now you have a very interesting situation. Bush is trying to triangulate the same way Bill Clinton did, to compartmentalize these different things and move forward with an agenda. How do you profess to move forward with an agenda when the people who work under you have been subverting you and keeping things from you for the last 4 years, it seems?
Well, you know, that's going to be an interesting thing. But the most interesting thing, I think, right now is by the end of the week, we're going to have indictments. We're going to have whatever Fitzgerald has been working on is going to come out. We're going to know a lot more in the next couple of days. And we can speculate all we want, but there are still speculations that are going to need to be done after those indictments come out and after that information comes out. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking a little bit about the forged yellow cake uranium document.
Dirty business.
Out of Italy that has been fairly confirmed, according to Raw story, that Fitzgerald actually, you know, asked for these, and he's had them for up to a year.
Yeah, we talked about this briefly last week, because Justin Raimondo on antiwar.com. By the way, Justin Raimondo is no progressive. He is a conservative, okay,
right,
in the Pat Buchanan mold. He has been saying this for a while, and now it is starting to become confirmed that Fitzgerald was digging last year a lot deeper than most people thought into exactly what went on in this Plaingate situation.
And also begin to look for the right-wing smear of Fitzgerald, because that's what they're going to start doing. They're going to start talking about how he's biased, how he's overzealous, how he's, you know, maybe even partisan. But let me tell you something. He is a classic federal prosecutor in that he scares the hell out of the likes of terrorists, mobsters, and politicians. This guy will go after the worst of them with a passionate intensity that his enemies will certainly call overzealous, but, you know, he's a classic and he is necessary. There's very few like him. I've never seen one of his type in my lifetime, but I imagine there was some back in the day. I guess Robert Kennedy was kind of like this, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, and see, the thing with Fitzgerald that was interesting to me is that he really doesn't care who it is he upsets. He upset many people in our profession when he went after Judith Miller. Oh, how could he? Press freedom, blah, blah, blah. Didn't matter to him. He got the information he was looking for. Now, you're right. He's going to start getting smeared from the other side of the equation, from the right wing. He's biased. What do they want? An evangelical Christian prosecutor to look into all of this so nobody will get indicted?
Right, exactly. Given all the shortcomings and given his personal declaration that he is not acting in a partisan way, it seems like guys like Fitzgerald are rare and necessary when the political culture and the culture of the press has become so irresponsible and corrupt that there is no barometer for integrity in either. So it is important that, you know, he gets his stuff done. And I'm very excited about him. I kind of like him. You know, I'm not a sports fan. I've become a Patrick Fitzgerald fan.
Well, yeah, why not? And let's compare for a moment Patrick Fitzgerald and his motives and where he's coming from, and Ken Starr and where he was coming from. There is no comparison. Fitzgerald is head and shoulders over him.
Absolutely. We lost a very important person yesterday, Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white man in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, and sparked the modern civil rights movement, is dead at 92.
Incredible woman. I interviewed her twice, once when she first began the Institute for Self-Development that she named after herself and her husband in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Rosa Parks ended up having to leave Montgomery, Alabama, shortly after the end of the bus boycott due to threats, due to the fact she could not find work. She was a seamstress by trade, and she could not find work in Alabama. And by the way, after the boycott, you know, there were threats against her home, there were threats against Dr. King's home, because, of course, Rosa Parks' act of civil disobedience sparked the modern civil rights movement when it lured a young pastor from Atlanta by the name Martin Luther King Jr., who was like 20-something years old at the time,
yeah,
to Montgomery to lead this bus boycott. It was 381 days. Black people in Montgomery refused to ride the buses of the Montgomery transit system, and, you know, after those 381 days and a Supreme Court ruling, the boycott ended successfully. Rosa Parks then went to Hampton, Virginia, stayed there for a while, ended up in Detroit, I believe, around 1957-58, lived there with her husband, who passed away in 1977, worked for Congressman John Conyers, who we've talked to on numerous occasions before, as an aide in his office, I believe, until 1988 when she retired.
John Conyers doing the real work out there.
Absolutely, and Rosa Parks did the real work. And the thing about Rosa Parks was she was the most extraordinarily humble person I've ever talked to. She didn't see her own actions as being something she should be lauded for. She wasn't, you know, particularly interested in media attention. She was, on that level, a real, genuine person.
And had a good long life.
Absolutely.
92
years
old.
A life well spent.
Absolutely. Hey, look, folks, today we've got a pretty interesting show. We're going to have Paul Hackett on, the United States Marine Corps major and Iraq War veteran who came close to winning a special congressional election in Ohio this summer, announced on Monday that he is running for the U.S. Senate. We're going to talk to him on the phone in just a little while. We're going to get into a little more this modern-day Elliot Ness, Patrick Fitzgerald, and his investigation or possibility of looking into these Niger forgeries that came out of Italy, because we can start to speculate a little bit just how broad this investigation might be. And again, we are on indictment watch. A lot of these questions are going to be answered within the next few days. We got the iNews coming up. It's Tuesday. I hope you're having a good morning. It's 17 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. If you're just tuning in, according to the New York Times today, notes of Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose identity is at the heart of the leak investigation, from...
Is it?
Dick Cheney, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Looks like Dick Cheney is at the center of the leak investigation now. Who knows what's going to happen? It's clear that Scooter Libby most likely perjured himself. Perhaps even Dick Cheney lied under oath to the federal investigator, Patrick Fitzgerald, who, I tell you, Riley, is no slouch, man. You look at this guy's record. He's the real deal. I mean, before he was in Chicago, where he's currently a U.S. attorney, he was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. He brought charges against figures ranging from the Gambino crime family, the Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman for the 1993 World Trade Center attack.
Yeah, he's doing long time. Life.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden for the 1998 African embassy bombings. I mean, this guy is, you know, the real deal. He frightens terrorists, mobsters, and politicians. Politicians, of course, are the only ones that say, hey, you know, he's getting a little overzealous. You know, we're just doing our jobs here. No, you're not. Thank God he's going to, you know, be a barometer of some integrity to this hellhole that we live in, both on the level of the press and the politics. Well, look, let's talk about this, because you got to explain something to me. It can be assumed that Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald has expanded his probe to include intelligence information that the Bush administration bent into their foundation for their case for war. That was kind of a poem.
Mm-hmm.
He had talked last week, we had talked about this last week, about the Italian forgeries of documents substantiating potential transactions of uranium between Iraq and Niger. Now, I read something in Raw Story. You read something in Raimondo's column.
Antiwar.com.
What can be gleaned from the documents that have been posted on Fitzgerald's website in relation to Judith Miller's conversations with a government official concerning Iraqi efforts to buy yellowcake uranium is that, you know, he obviously, it's been, apparently the United International Press Monday confirmed that Fitzgerald's investigators have sought and obtained documentation on these Italian forgeries. Now, what does this mean for the investigation, Riley?
Well, it means, and we talked very briefly about this and vaguely on purpose last week, it may possibly be that these Niger forgeries were done not by Italians, but by Americans, who then routed the documents through the Italians, and then they wound up back in the U.S.
So
and
this is dark, covert, secret ops
dark
stuff.
Dark, covert, very mysterious stuff. And among the questions that Fitzgerald is believed to have asked is why this information which, by the way, came from an Italian journalist
and
went through the U.S. Embassy in Rome. Why wasn't it vetted in Rome before it got back to Washington? According to reports I've seen, both in Raw Story and in antiwar.com, they are saying that information like this, intelligence like this, would normally have been vetted by intelligence people at the U.S. Embassy in Rome. Somehow it got... It went through without being looked at, straight to Washington.
Now, what does this mean? If he was able to tie these forgeries, if they, let's say hypothetically, if they were done by an American, funneled through the Italian press, you know, to substantiate the claim of the Iraq nuclear weapons manufacturing intentions, you know, what does it mean? What if they can tie this to Dick Cheney? What if this goes all the way up to the top? What does that mean for Dick Cheney? What are we looking at?
Well, I don't know what it means for Dick Cheney, but here's what it means, according to antiwar.com, in terms of the people who actually allegedly committed the forgeries, because they would have been guilty of violating at least two different laws, one of which states as follows, quote, whoever in any manner within the jurisdiction of the executive, legislative, or judicial branch of the government of the United States, knowingly and willfully, one, falsifies, conceals, or covers up by any trick, scheme, or device a material fact, two, makes any materially false, fictitious, or fraudulent statement or representation, or three, makes or uses any false writing or document knowing the same to contain any materially false, fictitious, or fraudulent statement or entry shall be fined under this title and imprisoned not more than 5 years.
What? Oh, so that means that these guys, if they get busted on the forgery, can go to jail for 5 years.
But there's another part of this, which I don't want to read, but that's another 5 years.
But, all right, but where's the part where it says that if we can tie this to the broader conspiracy, that if we can follow those forgeries up the chain through the White House Iraq Group's office, what happens then? I mean, if he's able to do that, that's a serious conspiracy charge. It's a serious cover-up charge. It's an espionage charge.
That would be indictments aplenty.
Yeah, I mean, that would be just mind-blowing if he has the information to tie all that stuff together.
Well, it looks like he asked for it some time ago, and he's got it. And
wow.
I'm talking now about the information from the Italian government, who investigated all this stuff themselves, by the way.
This is unbelievable to me because, you know, as we speculate, you know, this thing's all going to come down the next couple of days, so we're going to have some answers.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, it's getting exciting because how could you not just sit here and go, holy mackerel, they're going to take them all down. They're going to take them all down. They got the forgeries. This is like global espionage.
Yeah, it is global espionage.
Oh, it's very exciting, Riley. We're going to do the iNews when we come back. We're going to also... talk a little bit more about Cheney, obviously, and Paul Hackett.
Yeah.
We've got a big show, 27 past, Air America Radio's Morning Edition. Before past the hour, good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. If you're just turning on that radio, just crawling out of bed, if your alarm just went off, wake up. According to the New York Times today, notes of Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer undercover, Valerie Plame, whose identity is the heart of the leak investigation from, do it again, that's right, folks, from Dick Cheney himself, the vice president. And this happened weeks before her identity became public in July 2003. Apparently, there was a conversation between Libby and Cheney on June 12, 2003, and this means, people, that Libby perjured himself because he told the grand jury that he heard it from journalists, and it might mean that Cheney lied to Fitzgerald under oath last year. So there's your ringleader. It's Dick Cheney. We all knew it. We all knew it couldn't have been George Bush because he doesn't really run the country. Morning's Edition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant for another live broadcast next Thursday, November 3rd. That place was amazing. They won us over with free bagels and lox. They had coffee, they had little baskets of muffins.
Yeah, Mike O'Neill's a great guy.
A very great guy. So come on down. We're going to have comedian Lisa Lampanelli, Vanity Fair's James Wolcott. That's next Thursday, November 3rd at O'Neill's on West 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West. You can always email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. Also, podcasting is available if you go to morningsedition.com. That seems to be the way that a lot of people are able to listen to us. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying, my friends. So luckily we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's kick it up and feed it some headlines. There you go. Ah, man, I feel like he's going to be back on Thursday, Brendan P.W. McDonald. From Reuters, Condoleezza Rice hones campaign skills but denies running. Condoleezza Rice hones campaign skills but denies running. Candidate Condi has got the lying part down. All right. From ABC News, average U.S. gas prices dropped 25 cents. Average U.S. gas prices dropped 25 cents. Translation. That would be prices fall from holy to no in way. How about this one? Forget treason. Road trip. All right. From the Associated Press, prison population continued to grow in 2004. Prison population continued to grow in 2004. Translation, wait till Patrick Fitzgerald gets done. Yeah. How about this one? This is good. Prison population continued to grow in 2004. Here's the other translation. Bush administration reports record growth in housing the poor and disenfranchised. Oh, yes, I got it in the garbage. Boy, the small things really make you happy, don't they, Riley?
Sometimes
it's the little things. Hey, let's talk about Iraq. A gruesome incident that involved the killings of four U.S. contractors by an angry Sunni mob that happened last month was just reported over the weekend, which means what, people? Which means the deaths were hidden from the press. The contractors worked for Kellogg Brown Root, were in a convoy, and had taken a wrong turn about 45 miles outside of Baghdad. They were pursued by dozens of Sunni Arab insurgents carrying rocket launchers and automatic rifles. They were shot. Two were killed in the initial shooting. The other two were pulled from their vehicle. One was shot in the back of the head, and the other was set on fire and burned to death as children gathered around laughing and throwing straw on the burning man. The soldiers that were escorting the contractors were not able to get there in time to save them. These were details that appeared in the London Telegraph over the weekend. They could not be independently verified, but the incident resembles an incident in 2004, as you remember, when a mob brutally killed four U.S. security contractors, mutilated their bodies, and hung them from a bridge. Now, that was really the last time, Riley, you saw any in-depth reporting on the killing of contractors. It was so heinous and disturbing that it was snuffed out, and then the war-sympathetic media that was war-sympathetic at the time, it disappeared within days.
Well, yeah, and in this instance, we're talking about an incident that took place on September 20th. It was first reported this past Saturday by the Daily Telegraph in Britain, and then a senior U.S. military commander confirmed it to the Washington Post. That was the first time that it came forward in American media.
Over a month later, the point is that 320 non-Iraqi civilian contractors have been killed in Iraq since the start of the war. Many of these are American casualties that are not included in the body accounts, nor are the casualties that die later here in the U.S. This is part of the way the military filters, stifles, and censors the truth out of the war to make it seem less disastrous than it is. And we are slowly approaching now. I mean, we are, you know, it's probably arguable at this point how many U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq, because we're up to 1,999.
Well, yeah, and we've seen over the last, 48 hours, some devastating attacks, suicide car bombs, one of which was right outside the green zone, the safe, secure green zone.
Right, and how many American deaths do we not know about? I mean, when you hear something like this, and these are contractors, but how much of a cover-up is there? How much are they trying to manage this war in terms of our dead, of civilian dead? And then you look at the fact that despite the fact that enemy body counts are usually skewed, and there was a refusal on behalf of this military to report them, they've started to put out the numbers occasionally of enemy body counts. This was apparently a harbinger of doom in Vietnam. It is a desperate tactic on behalf of the military to bolster public support for the war by trying to make a connection between numbers of supposed enemy killed with pending victory. All right, the military stopped doing this in Vietnam because you couldn't make that connection. And there are a lot of problems here. I mean, in a guerrilla war like the Vietnam War and like this war, just because you kill a number of people does not mean that that they, not number one, aren't easily replaceable, and number two, when you don't know how many of the enemy there are, what the hell difference does it make if you start reporting those numbers?
Well, see, in Vietnam, this was an incremental situation where, you know, every night we would hear about the various Allied offensives and numbers of North Vietnamese troops that were killed. What it did for the first, I think right up until the Gulf of Tonkin in 1968, was convince most Americans that America was winning the war. That, you know, these bodyguards, how could we be losing when we'd have one American killed and 200 Viet Cong killed?
Right.
This was something that we never heard about South Vietnamese troops that were killed. But what it did was give Americans the false impression that the war was being won. And it really wasn't until that the early spring, summer of 1968 that people began to seriously question the connection between the body count and impending victory.
Well, in this type of war, you know, when you hear even, when you hear Brent Scowcroft talking about the nature of what is going on in Iraq and what he saw was going to happen in Iraq if George W. Bush went in and did this invasion, is that you are getting, guerrilla situation, you're getting snipers, you're getting people that just blow people up, roadside bombs. Now, the effectiveness of that type of warfare has really nothing to do with body counts. I mean, those are, you know, these are singular guys that are apparently easily replaceable, willing to die, and we don't even know how many there really are.
No.
And just the fact that they're reporting some are dead or enemies are being killed, what it does give a sort of death, based morale boost to troops, but it is misleading to people here in the States or people who are watching TV that it implies that there is a pending victory. I mean, you know, body counts are usually stilted in that they include civilians, like women and children, and they differ wildly from witness accounts, given that, the military counts are always questioned by people who see it on the ground.
Well, it's no accident that this whole body count thing has begun in the wake of Condoleezza Rice trying to happy talk the Senate into believing that the war, that the war in Iraq is going well. This is part and parcel of a coordinated administration effort to make the war look like something that it absolutely is not.
Yeah.
And that is successful.
Well, look, folks, the sad milestone has been hit, according to CNN. We are now at 2,000 deaths as of, this morning. As of just now, we have been seeing that on CNN, they are reporting 2,000 American military deaths in Iraq as of now.
As of now. And this is something, by the way, that the Bush administration has long dreaded because they know that all of these other situations come back to Iraq and the Iraq policy. Now, Bush may not believe that he was wrong in invading Iraq, but he has certainly got to be thinking at this point, after 2,000 U.S. deaths, that somebody gave him some bad information somewhere.
Well, I'll tell you, that information seemed to emanate and was bent and, reshaped by the White House Iraq group that was put together specifically to build propaganda to make the public believe that this was a justified war. And at the head of that, outside of Andrew Card, was Dick Cheney. The bottom line is that Dick Cheney and his neocon cohorts put the White House Iraq group together to dupe the American people with skewed intelligence into going into a war that was based on lies and has made the world a more dangerous place, and today has killed 2,000 American soldiers and thousands of Iraqi civilians, not to mention the thousands of American soldiers that are coming home compromised with injuries, mental injuries, lost limbs, pieces of shrapnel inside them, parts of their bodies blown off. I mean, and the bottom line is that, what we're finding out now is that this was a group of people within the White House, Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, Karl Rove, that were willing to, again, after bringing us into war based on a lie, after trying to sell that lie, we're willing to compromise global national security to seek reprisal against someone who criticized them, Joe Wilson, who was willing and had the courage to tell the truth about the lies they were putting together to mislead the American people. There's no way to justify this war as being anything but a disaster and the wrong thing to do.
Absolutely true. And, we're at a point now where the American people are starting to see the sham that this administration has really run and the game that has been run on them. Those troops that are over there and God love them all. And I hope they all come back safe. But they went over for an unnecessary war based on not just one lie, but on a series of lies.
Yeah, and speaking about a series of lies, we've got a story here that someone forwarded me that I thought was interesting. It showed itself about a week ago in Fox, in Variety. Rupert Rupert Murdoch, you know, he has a kid who was in charge of his business, of News Corps. He was the deputy chief of operations. This was his kid, Lachlan Murdoch. And he has resigned. And in that vacuum, Roger Ailes, some of you know him as a former GOP propaganda mastermind, became chairman of the station groups at Fox. And they are planning on putting something that looks a lot like Fox News, the cable network, on 35 broadcast outlets. Speaking of lies and propaganda dispersal and right-wing agitprop, it looks like it's going nationwide and it's going to a much broader audience, and we're going to talk a little bit in detail about that in just a couple of minutes. We'll also share with you the Cliff Notes. Again, Dick Cheney has been implicated as the head, as the main leaker, and also I want to say that that we have hit the grim milestone of 2,000 American military dead in Iraq. Stay with us. It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. It's 46 past the hour.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
It's 50 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Hey, folks, you got to hang out. Paul Hackett, the United States Marine Corps major and Iraq War veteran who came close to winning a special congressional election in Ohio this summer, announced on Monday that he is running for the U.S. Senate. He's going to join us on the phone here in a few minutes to tell us what he's got on his mind in terms of what he's going to do to change this country. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A Freedom of Information lawsuit has revealed documents that show the FBI has conducted surveillance on U.S. residents without proper authority or oversight. The FBI records were turned over after a Freedom of Information lawsuit by a privacy advocacy group whose leader, the FBI noted, makes frequent trips to an adult bookstore and once dented a parked car without leaving a note. The FBI said they would keep people under surveillance for as long as 18 months at a time, only if, quote, the storyline was good and the characters really developed. A new McDonald's ad campaign is focusing on the quality of McDonald's food and the company's safety practices. McDonald's hopes the new campaign will eradicate the perception that McDonald's burgers are filled with additives and other non-beef ingredients. They aren't. The cows that are turned into McDonald's beef are filled with additives and other non-beef ingredients. Wow, these are long. Yeah, it's good. Good. These are rich. They're deep. The Cleveland father, who was accused of keeping adopted special needs kids in cages, is saying he did it for their safety. The children were removed from their home from the home last month and sent to foster homes with more upscale cages. The foster parents said, quote, let's face it, after this kind of upbringing, these kids are bound to end up in jail eventually anyways. This will make the transition a lot easier. Privately, the father asked, quote, do you know how much more it costs to raise free-range children? Free-range children.
Uh-oh.
You can't lose with that. All right, let's get into this creepy bit of business. Rupert Murdoch's son, Lachlan, resigned as a News Corps deputy chief operations officer. In that vacuum, Roger Ailes, who worked as a media advisor for Nixon during the 1967-68 presidential campaign, Roger Ailes, who worked as a consultant to Ronald Reagan in 1984, Roger Ailes, who was part of the Lee Atwater camp, I think they were partners at one time, who spawned Karl Rove, who worked on George H.W. Bush's 1988 presidential campaign, Roger Ailes has now been promoted to chairman of the station groups at Fox, which means he's in charge of all television stations owned by News Corps. So dig that. That's right. The format that fabricates the news every day on cable is going network. News Corps owns both Fox and UPN affiliates in the top three media markets, New York, L.A., and Chicago, and others in six more of the major markets, 26 markets in all. They are going to start pulling all those stations under the evil Fox News umbrella and try to generate that type of programming. They're actually even, they're having seminars. They're bringing in local talent, news talent from these different affiliates to cram at seminars in these sort of casual right-wing agitprop stylings of Fox News. This is scary stuff because it's a gamble on a lot of levels for him, which I don't care about. My question is, Riley, will it work? Will the kids dig the hate? Will he spawn a new generation of brainwashed hate zombies to fuel the Republican Party as a religious base withers away? just plain stupid ignorance, Trump's religious ignorance in numbers anytime. And I'm worried because these markets are younger, they're hipper, and they're in a sense they're kids that may not be as critical of the news.
Well, what Roger Ailes is trying to do is a grafting, a news grafting, if you look at it in surgical terms. What he's done now, Fox News Channel, because the Fox Network, which is different than the Fox News Channel, the Fox Network are the local affiliates, for example, Channel 5 here in New York, that carry Fox programming. They don't have a national newscast. They don't have a newscast like ABC and NBC and CBS. So, and they also don't have that kind of national news staff. So when they've been covering, for example, the Republican National Convention, when the local Fox, they've been picking up the feed from the Fox News Channel. So Ailes gets this idea. He says, wait a minute, why don't we try grafting some of the elements of the Fox News Channel that have made it popular, the most popular cable news channel in the country, and graft that onto the local affiliates? Number one, it will save some money. Number two, it will, in theory, increase ratings. The problem he's got is this. Fox News Channel has the second oldest list viewing audience of any cable channel, second only to CNBC, which was also started by Roger Ailes.
Okay. So he's going after the kids.
He's going after the kids because the Fox Network, as opposed to the Fox News Channel, has a much younger audience. And the chance he's taking is that the kind of old-school conservatism that the Fox News Channel promotes every hour of every day will work on these local news channels. Maybe they'll do the structure differently. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Maybe make it a more like an MTV News kind of thing. But don't think for a moment that Ailes won't have a conservative bent to anything he puts on these networks.
Right. And also, he's saying he's not afraid to get into that national news market. He might even put somebody up against the big three.
Yeah, he might, but I don't know, because that time is pretty profitable for the O&Os, which are the owned and operated Fox stations. Now, the Fox network is not just the Fox station. It's also UPN. They made a deal a few years ago, so that now Fox co-owns the UPN stations and the Fox stations. That's what they mean when they say duopolies in different markets across the country.
Right. Well, what I know and what I glean from this story is that there's going to be more of that, which pollutes the great, you know, collective unconscious of this country and steers them to the right. I think that on a bottom line, this guy is a political operative. I like the way when you read the story in Variety, they're presenting it as just a show business story. But this is a very dangerous manifestation of propaganda that's going to hit the country in a much larger way than it has before.
Well, yeah, and you have to realize that local news has become a major profit center for virtually every local television station in America. And what he's talking about doing is changing fundamentally the focus and the tone of local news.
All right, well, just in a couple minutes here, people, we're going to be talking to Paul Hackett, who is going to be running for Senate. As you know, he's the Iraqi war vet that made a pretty good run for it, Congress there in Ohio, in a district that was primarily Republican. And he's an inspirational guy. I saw him on CNN the other day. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with him. 57 past, Air America Radio's Morning Citizen. Six past the hour. Good morning, people. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It is Tuesday. There's a weird yin and yang mixture of horror and glee here. CNN is reporting that the grim milestone of 2,000 American military dead has been hit this morning. According to CNN, online and on television, it's been reported today that 2,000 American military personnel have been killed since the invasion of Iraq. And on the other side of the spectrum, my friends, listen to this. According to the New York Times today, notes of Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer, Valerie Plame, whose identity is the heart of the leak investigation from That's right, Dick Cheney, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. This was weeks before her identity became public in 2003. There was a conversation between Libby and Cheney on June 12, 2003. This means that Libby perjured himself because he told the grand jury that he heard it from journalists. It might mean that Cheney as well lied to Fitzgerald under oath last year. Now, I guess you can't call what Cheney did a leak because he had security clearance. Let's make that clear because we talked about that before the show.
Yeah.
I'm looking at an email from somebody who is calling us on something similar. So that is the case, that Libby and Cheney both had security clearance. So let's not call it a leak, but the dispersal of the information by Libby through whatever means it was dispersed, which will become clear by the end of the week in the indictment,
oh, yeah,
is a leak.
Well, yeah. Also, Mark, I just want to intervene here. It's also illegal if Cheney conspired with Libby to leak the name to people who did not have classified status, then Cheney is guilty of taking part in that conspiracy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if it was a plan, and that's always been the assumption, just how big the plan of conspiracy was, whether it was just Libby and Cheney, whether it was Rove, Libby and Cheney, whether it was Card, Libby, Rove, and Cheney, whether it was Mary Matlin, Card, Libby, Cheney, and Rove, whether it was, you know, Hadley, Cheney, Libby, Rove, Matlin, you know, it's just how big that group is certainly under examination. But we do know at the center of the gyre, of the swirling, is it a guy? What am I thinking of? I'm thinking of a poem by Yeats, The Widening Gyre. I don't even know what that is. The center cannot hold. The falcon has lost touch with the falconer, the second coming.
I'll look that up, Mark. We're going to move on for right now.
Okay, sorry. The Widening Gyre. Well, anyways. The center that cannot hold, is Dick Cheney. How about that? And he is the strange beast that slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. That's the deal.
Well, look, what we're seeing now is a sliding timeline, and the timeline is sliding backwards. Remember that at the beginning of all this, the important date was July 14, 2003. That was the day that Novak's column outing Valerie Plame was first published. Now we go back to June 12th of that same year, and we see an article in the Washington Post that says that an unnamed American diplomat had gone to Niger to check out the allegation that Iraq was trying to buy yellow cake uranium and had come back and said that that report was not corroborated by the facts. Later that same day, apparently, Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney talk about Joe Wilson, who was the American diplomat who was referred to in that particular article. Now, we can sit here and speculate and say to ourselves, well, maybe, you know, Cheney and Libby just said, well, gee, you see this article in the Washington Post?
Right.
Wow, that's interesting. Let's move on and talk about welfare reform. Maybe that's what happened.
Right.
But I don't think so. I think at that point, Dick Cheney's very specific interest in Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame began to take shape. And the question now will be, for what purpose?
Obviously, we're on indictment watch. Some of this stuff will be answered by the end of the week. Gyre, a circular or spiral form, a vortex.
There you go.
Yeah. So the center of the vortex is Dick Cheney. In a couple of minutes, folks, I'm very excited. We're going to be talking to Paul Hackett. Paul Hackett, of course, is a United States Marine Corps major and Iraq War veteran who came close to winning a special congressional election in Ohio this summer. Announced on Monday that he's running for the U.S. Senate. And just right off the bat, there in his announcement speech, you know, I was sucked in. He basically said in his pitch when he announced he was running for Senate, quote, "I'm asking all the people of this great state, regardless of political affiliation, to consider my message and to consider joining me in the fight to take back our government from the career politicians and their special interest support groups who have hijacked our government." Coming up in a couple of minutes, Paul Hackett will talk to us on the phone, so stick around for that. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. No, make that 16. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Morning.
Stick around for a conversation that Mark and I had with Amy Tan about her new book. But right now, our next guest lit up Ohio and U.S. politics this summer when he narrowly lost a race for U.S. Congress in a traditionally Republican district in Ohio. If you thought that he'd disappear from the political landscape, you're wrong, folks. He's a U.S. Marine who served 7 months in Iraq, including time spent in Fallujah. He announced yesterday that he will run for the U.S. Senate in 2006. Paul Hackett joins us on the phone from Ohio this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, people of New York.
Good morning. How you doing?
Right on, man. Good. I'm glad you're well. You know, I saw a bit about you on CNN the other night, and I'm very excited to talk to you. So what made you decide? Was this a difficult decision to say I'm going to run for Senate?
Well, hey, the nice thing about it is I certainly had more time to think about it and decide with my family whether or not we wanted to jump on this horse and take it for a ride.
Put yourself through that, huh?
Yeah, you know, hey, look, it's a big challenge.
Uh-huh.
I think probably what made my wife and I commit to do it was truly the sense of service and the sense that we need more citizen legislators to step up and try to bring back good government for the rest of us out here who feel like the career politicians have sort of left us behind so that they can kind of go on their merry way manipulating the process
yeah.
and screwing things up.
Now, do you find that you got to go up against this Congressman Sherrod Brown in the primary? Is he one of these kind of guys that you're talking about, a career politician?
Who?
Uh-oh.
So you're not worried about it?
Worried about what?
About beating this guy.
Look, I mean this seriously.
Yes, sir.
There's a lot of talk about me running against so-and-so and me running against so-and-so or this other person or stuff like that. This is honestly how I look at it. I'm not running against them. I'm not running against anybody. I am running to represent all Ohio. That's my agenda. My agenda is not to just go out and defeat one person or two people, because perhaps maybe unlike most career politicians, I don't view this as something about me. This is something about everybody in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I'm a realist. I'm sure there are people out there and they hear this and they go, oh my God, the guy sounds like a politician, you know. But that's who I am. And if you don't think that's who I am, stop and scratch your head and ask yourself whether I would have just gone to Iraq because I don't believe in serving my country.
Right.
I believe in serving my country, and that's what this is all about in my book. It's not about me. It's not about some other politician who wants to be a senator from Ohio. That's how I feel about it.
Now, Paul Hackett, it appears as though I've seen a couple of quotes from you that say that the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has kind of been pressuring you to bow out. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, I think that's kind of gotten blown out of proportion. Not really. I think, well, first of all, they encouraged me to get in, which was kind of amazing to me that anybody would pick up the phone and call me to run for Senate from the great state of Ohio. But to the extent that that happened, I would say strategically the powers that be in Washington, D.C. would like to avoid a primary. And I think probably if they want to make that happen quite seriously, the people who they should talk to are their brethren in Washington, D.C.
Our guest is Paul Hackett, a U.S. Marine and Iraq War veteran running for U.S. Senate in Ohio. Let's talk about the war, Paul. There's a lot of Democrats that just don't have any sort of courage to stand up against this war. You were in the war. What is your stand on it?
Well, you know, let me highlight something. I'm not sure if you guys have talked about it this morning, but it was just announced this morning that over the weekend we just hit a milestone at 2000.
We did mention that.
In Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think it's particularly complicated. I mean, if you stop and you look at Iraq and look at what's taken place over there objectively, take the emotion out of it, take the nationalism out of it, just look at it objectively. Look at how the military has been used, what the military has been asked to do over there, and then compare objective successes And I think if anybody just locked themselves in a room all by themselves and did the pluses and the minuses on columns like my 8-year-old daughter has to do in science class, I think you come up with one conclusion, and that is thus far it's been an objective failure. And number two, if you really ask yourself honestly, is it going to be turned around? I find it difficult to find any objective evidence that would lead me to believe that we're going to turn this around. So the question then becomes, how do we as a nation, Democrats, Republicans, libertarians, and whatever your stripe of political persuasion is, how do we get together and extricate ourselves from this and make the best out of a bad situation? And I personally am not big on pointing the fingers. As much as I disagree with this administration, as much heartburn as I've got with this administration, it's not going to fix the problem for us as a nation, and it's not going to fix the problem for my brothers and sisters in service over in Iraq. So what do we do? Here's some suggestions. Number one, I'll work under the assumption that this administration made a good faith mistake on what got us into Iraq, i.e. searching for weapons of mass destruction.
You're going to make that assumption, Paul?
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
You're a nice guy.
If that helps us as a nation get towards extricating ourselves from that situation.
Well, maybe you'll rethink that after the indictments this week. We'll see.
Yeah, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. But,
yes.
Unfortunately, that's what career politicians do, and that's why we're in the mess we're in as a nation.
Paul Hackett, are you in favor of a phased troop withdrawal a la Russell Feingold?
I'm not familiar with his program, so I'm not going to adopt it by name. But what I am in favor of is, first of all, the Pentagon structures any task that the civilian administration gives it. So I'm in favor of this administration, the Bush administration, tasking the Pentagon to make a safe, timely withdrawal beginning now from Iraq. Because if you look objectively, there's been no objective success. Iraq is less secure today than it was a year ago, 2 years ago, or 2.5 years ago. The infrastructure is worse today in Iraq than it was when we got there. The water infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure, all of that is worse today than when we got there 2.5 years ago. We've not spread democracy there. America is not safer today than it was 2.5 years ago before we invaded.
Right.
And, you know, this discussion about we've got to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over there or over here, you know, that's nonsense. We had a righteous fight in Afghanistan. We allowed ourselves to be distracted from that righteous fight in Afghanistan, where if we so chose, we could take on the terrorists.
Our guest is Paul Hackett, U.S. Marine and Iraq War veteran, running for U.S. Senate in Ohio. Now, let me ask you, Paul, in response to the people criticize the news media saying that they never cover the good things. Now, you were in Iraq. You spent some time there. What is there anything good going on? What is your reaction to that criticism?
Well, the only thing good going on in Iraq on our end of the stick is all the hardworking men and women in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fighting like hell, and they're working night and day to try to accomplish a mission that the military is not designed to accomplish, and that's nation building. And if your viewers recall, President Bush said back in 2000, in 1999, when he was running for election, running for the White House, he said, "I'm not going to use the military to nation build." And guess what, folks? We're nation building. We're painting schools. We're spending $200 billion over the course of the last 2.5 years to try to nation build. And it's not just, you know, rebuild. It's actual creation of a nation from the ground up. And through the mismanagement and misjudgment of this administration, they missed that point. You know, they honestly believed that we're going to go in there and people were going to be tossing flowers at us and welcoming us, and they thought that was going to last. I mean, that's just that is political hubris at its best.
Absolutely. We're talking to Paul Hackett, who is running for U.S. Senate in Ohio. Now, what if, let's go back to your good faith idea about this administration. Let's say in the next couple of weeks that we find that George W. Bush completely fabricated the evidence that he based his invasion on. Would that change your opinion?
Well, look, I'm being somewhat glib when I give you that argument.
Of course, yeah.
And my opinion is the war is over. Anything that can be accomplished long-term has been accomplished. And the challenge is, as I referred to earlier, to, in an orderly, safe way, get our troops out of Iraq, use them in Afghanistan to accomplish what we started in Afghanistan, and for whatever reason, this administration lost its focus in Afghanistan.
Right.
That's where the righteous fight is.
Okay.
Do it there.
Thank you, Paul. Hey, you know, I wish you luck, and we'll be in touch with you as you move towards
plug the website, Hackett for Ohio.
You got
right.
it. You just
Thanks
did.
A lot, man.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you
to help. You take
Thank
care.
You. Thank you.
That was Paul Hackett running for Senate in Ohio. We will, continue our show momentarily with an Amy Tan interview, so stick around for that. It's 27 past the hour. And Riley, I think he's got a chance.
Oh, yeah.
All right. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron. Here's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Sadly, folks, we've reached the grim milestone of 2,000 American military dead in Iraq. That was hit this morning. It was reported in the 6 o'clock hour here on the East Coast. Also, according to the New York Times, today, the notes of Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer, Valerie Plame, whose identity is at the heart of this leaked scandal from Dick Cheney. We will get into that in a little while, but it looks like Cheney is the center, the disperser, the beginning of the leak situation. First off, I want to talk about this. First off, Bill Frist. First off, how could anybody could have believed that Bill Frist actually had millions of dollars invested in his own family's business that he knew nothing about on purpose? It's ridiculous. Okay, and now it's being proven that he lied. It might be illegal. He might be guilty of insider trading. As it turns out, all that money he had in a blind trust, that he had it in a blind trust so he could conduct senatorial business without being compromised by his holdings, was all being reported to him. Am I right, Riley? Not once, not twice, but
15 times.
Yes, it had been reported that the trustees of HCA, i.e., the family for profit hospital business that the Frist family owned, had written to Frist 15 times detailing the sale of assets from or the contribution of assets to trusts of the Frist and family.
Well, yeah, and see, why this is important, ladies and gentlemen, is because Bill Frist, A, said that the blind trusts were, quote, totally blind. But beyond that, Bill Frist sold short. When it looked like his stock in HCA had reached its peak, he sold off a bunch of it and then watched as the stock declined by 9%.
And he's under investigation by the Security Exchange Commission. And last week, Frist told reporters that he is, quote, absolutely confident in the outcome. What is it with these Republicans? That's exactly what DeLay said. It's just like they're absolutely confident. Just absolutely confident. The confidence is like this right-wing talking point. I mean, because DeLay said the exact same thing. It's against the rules of the right to show any humility until you are utterly humiliated. Then you are put out to pasture or put into jail until they can sneak you in at a later date to do some real dirty work. You know, like only an ex-con can. See Elliot Abrams, John Poindexter, John Negroponte, Oliver North, Henry Kissinger, Neil Bush. John Gotti. Granted, they're all not cons, but you dig what I'm saying. So he is under investigation by the SEC, and it has become clear that he lied, and that whether or not that'll result in an indictment, what happens next, Riley?
Well, what will happen next is that the SEC will complete its report. If that report is damaging enough, At the very least, there may be some indictment of Bill Frist, or at the very least, there may be some pressure on him to step down as Senate Majority Leader.
I think he's toast, you know, and I think that Trent Lott is sitting there waiting to get his old job back. And I also think that, as Bill Frist said, that this will affect whether or not he runs in 2008. I think we can honestly say that he's dead in 2008. It's over.
I would say it is extremely problematic. You never say never in politics because people can reinvent themselves like Madonna. But bottom line, this really deals a death blow, perhaps a mortal blow, to his presidential hopes.
Well, he's such a wishy-washy bastard anyways. I don't know how he could reinvent himself. Talking about a guy that's just spineless, that guy's the guy.
Well, you know, he may go for another round of religious broadcasters. And,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Go, hey, here I am. I love everything you people stand for. He may do that. That's possible.
Yeah.
Although it may not work.
I don't think it will. Look, Riley and I talked to author Amy Tan the other day. She is the best-selling author of Saving Fish from Drowning. She's best known for the Joy Luck Club, and this is a chat we had a couple days ago. Our next guest is a New York Times best-selling author. She wrote The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, and The Opposite of Fate, among others. Her new book is called Saving Fish from Drowning, and she joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Amy Tan. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So where does the title, Saving Fish from Drowning, what is that about exactly?
Well, it's a funny title.
It is.
With a sort of a grim image. In Buddhist countries, you know, mm-hmm. you're not supposed to kill anything, and but people have to eat, and so the fishermen have this very bad karmic debt if they kill things. So what they do is actually they take fish out of the water to save them from drowning. And unfortunately, they don't make it. And so, you know, you don't want to waste anything, so you eat them later.
I get it. So it's sort of a poetic rationalization.
Yeah, you know, intentions, good intentions, right. Justification.
And the narrator of this book is a ghost. What is the story? Why don't you share a little bit of the story with us about that?
Well, there are 12 people, mm-hmm. Americans, who go on an art expedition along the Burma Road, starting in the Shangri-La of China. And they go into Myanmar, which is a country most people kind of, they don't know where it is, and that's because it was Burma, mm-hmm. renamed Myanmar by a military regime that took over in 1990. And these people end up with doing a number of mishaps, and on Christmas Day at sunrise, they disappear. Now, it's all told by a narrator, Bibi Chen, who's this very opinionated woman, and unfortunately she's dead because her throat was mysteriously slashed before the tour could begin, and she's come to us via automatic writing to tell us what really happened.
So is there a thriller element to this?
Well, some people have called it a thriller, which is quite a surprise to me. You know, suddenly find myself in that genre. I didn't intend for it to be thriller, but I hope it's thrilling.
Well, you're in a band with Stephen King, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Maybe you've been hanging out with Stephen King.
Yeah, maybe, yes, exactly. you know, and some people called it a mystery or an adventure.
Uh-huh.
It is, you know, the elements that I would hope would make people want to read a story. But the story has actually some serious intent to look at some issues having to do with people suffering, and what do we do about it? Can we do anything about it? Are we helpless to help people?
Do you have any of those answers for us?
No. You know, a novel never has answers.
That would have been so good.
We bring up questions. We're provocative.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, it seems as though, at least in some part of the book, you talk about the consequences of otherwise well-intentioned, I guess, actions. I guess some people might even call it unintended consequences. Talk a bit about that, and talk a bit about how consequences plays a role in the fate of these people who've disappeared.
Well, that is in part why I set the story in Burma, because that's a place that people have many different opinions on what they should do to help Burma. You know, you're supposed to boycott doing any business or going there. And some people say, no, we need to do constructive engagement, you know, lend a moral guiding hand. And other people say, oh, you should just go there to appreciate the culture and forget politics. And so there you're stuck with a moral response that you have to make. And you may have intentions that may be good, bad, indifferent. And let's say you want to help people. I mean, which one are you going to choose? Are you going to, you know, boycott Burma and go to Bali instead? I mean, how does that really help people? Or you're joining the collective. So it's It's a complicated question, and you can't always guarantee that your intentions and your actions are going to lead to the consequences you think are going to happen. And I've seen that in so many cases where people in human rights are going after, you know, documentaries expose terrible conditions in orphanages in China, and it has a terrible effect of closing down the orphanages and adoptions and things like that. So that's something somebody wouldn't have intended, but what do you do with that consequence? Who suffers that consequence, and then what is your moral response?
Wow, so that's a very challenging question, and I want to know also about the book. Is there a satirical element to it all, in terms of how you approach? I guess what is it? It's called the Global News Network, and now what's going on with that?
Well, I prefer to call it a comic element. Comic is a lot more broad, where you point out the absurdity of things, where satire is a little more sly and.
Yeah.
Satire is great for approaching subjects on a more serious level, but this, to me, was a story that was already so serious that the only way I could really approach it was through the comic of pointing out the absurdity of the government that is there in Burma and what they are doing. It is also looking at some of the ways that we use the media or reality shows to shape reality. I heard this comment a while back ago. It might have been 10 years ago or 8 years ago, via news network, and I can't remember which one, but it's, they said, "We make the news happen." And I thought, wow, you know, that's both good or bad, or depending on what you're making happen. And you see that all the time. You know, you put a focus on something, and you can change the outcome.
Sure.
You know, whether it's a little girl stuck in a well, or you put the spotlight on people in New Orleans and they need the help, or, you know, you put more focus on a particular issue.
That's interesting, because we make the news happen in another day and age. That could be a satirical statement of a news network, and now it's real.
It's real.
We're talking to Amy Tan. The new book is Saving Fish from Drowning, and you're also working on an opera. Is that true?
Yeah.
What is that about?
Well, it's based on The Bonesetter's Daughter.
Okay, that's
and
a book
it's
of yours.
It's a way of my not wasting my 15 years of classical piano.
writing the music?
No. I'm actually writing the libretto with Stuart Wallace, who's a wonderful composer. And he came to me with this idea, and I decided, looking at it, and I thought it was very intimidating. But I find now that it is a wonderful creative experience, you know, combining the notion of high music, high art, drama, literature, all of that, and into a form that is going to be staged. And we hope to take it, we plan to take it from the U.S., a number of cities in the U.S., and then to China. So we're doing a reverse immigration, a very American opera with Chinese textural elements in the instruments, and then going back to China.
Hmm. Now, my daughter would never forgive me if I didn't ask you. You had something to do with Sagwa.
Yeah, I'm sort of Britney's mom in the 5-year-old set, you know. I wrote a children's book called The Chinese Siamese Cat, and Sagwa was the little cat heroine of that, which was the name of my cat, actually. And it became a PBS television series.
Yeah, which my daughter absolutely loves.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Amy Tan, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the book. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 45 past the hour. We will be back momentarily with the Product Placement Minute. We've got the Liberal Confessional coming up as well. We've got all the top stories of the day. There's some grim stories. There's some also some stories that could make us rejoice a little bit. But the indictments are coming, folks, and they're going to be here by the end of this week. So we will have some definite information, but let's speculate some more after this. 46 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Fifty past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. It's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We're going to have the Liberal Confessional in a few minutes, and all the top stories are coming up. We're going to get into that. But we just got a call from management at Air America Radio here, and outside of my contract negotiations not going that well, they also say our show has to make more money, or else we'll have to do the show without microphones or a studio or any particular affiliation with the network. So,
you mean in the street?
Uh-huh. So here's today's product placement minute. So, Riley, what's in the news?
Raw sewage poured out of showers, toilets, and sinks in Rhode Island last week after floodwaters overtaxed the city's drainage system. Dozens of people are still homeless.
Wow. And what's our sponsor today?
J-Date, the largest Jewish singles network.
Great. You know, if you're single and Jewish, you ought to check out J-Date. What could it hurt?
More than 8 inches of rain fell within 24 hours, overwhelming the sewage system with storm runoff and groundwater. The regional treatment plant received 22 million gallons of sewage Saturday, 19 million gallons above average.
Here's a 35-year-old Jewish woman from New York who says she's caring and giving, and she's looking for a man with a playful and loving spirit. That's beautiful.
A geyser of excrement shot out of one man's toilet for 2 days, and six manhole covers in the town of West Warwick sprouted fountains of raw waste. The smell was unbearable.
Wow, I bet. And here's a nice young woman planning a trip to Peru in February. She also said she loves to dance.
Feces and urine have flooded basements throughout the area. Even a week after the flood, dozens of families still can't go home because of the filth, smell, and risk of disease.
And for the ladies, here's a guy who likes Chinese cooking. He says he's looking for, quote, a woman who is willing to live life to the fullest, unquote, and be his, quote, partner in crime, unquote. Say, maybe he's the right match for someone listening right now.
The stench of mold and sewage poses a serious health threat, and some homes were swamped so badly with liquid waste they'll have to be condemned.
I have two questions, Mark. First of all, is there any relief for these people? And second of all, who sounds cuter, that woman going to Peru or the caring and giving one?
Insurance companies are on site, Mark, but property values won't recover until someone can cap the unbearable reek of filth. And if I were single and Jewish, I'd probably go with the guy who's into Chinese cooking.
Wow, that's interesting. And that's today's product placement minute.
Lord have his mercy.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk a little bit about it, because I have to plead some ignorance in terms of some of the history. But Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white man in 1955, Montgomery, Alabama, thus sparking the modern civil rights movement, is dead at 92. And Riley, you gave us a little bit of an overview of her life, but it's interesting. I didn't realize that it was not a law. There was not a law against riding in the front of the bus.
Well, there were ordinances that apparently had some jurisdiction over this, but Rosa Parks was convicted of disorderly conduct.
Okay.
And what happened apparently was, and we should say first of all, Rosa Parks was a seamstress. She had been living in Montgomery for some time and had attended a school, a civil rights camp, actually in Tennessee, I believe it was, prior to taking this action. But she always maintained, and she told me this when I interviewed her, that this was a spontaneous decision the day she decided to do this, which was December 1st, 1955. And she decided not to give up her seat when a bus that she was riding on got full and a white man, first asked for the seat, and then the bus driver stopped the bus and told her she had to get up. And she said she was not getting up. They took her into custody, and apparently, according to some reports that I've seen, spent some time trying to decide what specifically to charge her with.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, she was convicted of disorderly conduct, and that began a 381-day boycott of the Montgomery bus system and by black people who lived in the town. And, of course, the bus system at that time could not survive without black patronage. And it really was the dawning and the beginning of the modern civil rights movement.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's as you said before, now, what was it? There was an action plan, but she was not going to be the one to take that action?
There were reports that were very widespread back in the day, actually, that Rosa Parks was not the first person who was going to be the trigger of this bus boycott, because there had been organizations, including the NAACP, who had wanted to challenge the bus boycott from years earlier. The NAACP generally did not challenge by civil disobedience. At that time, they generally went to the courts and tried to get something done. Now, the year after the boycott in 1956, the Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that said that Rosa Parks' conviction was unconstitutional, in fact.
Okay. Well, look, folks, next week we'll return to O'Neill's Restaurant for another live broadcast next Thursday, November 3rd. O'Neill's, it was great the last time. They had free lox, bagels, cream cheese. They put little baskets of muffins and rolls on the table.
And yeah. It doesn't matter. I mean, I scheduled this live broadcast. I'm actually not going to be here next week. And that was real. I had a real conflict of interest. You know me, Mark. You know how much I love food, especially bagels and lox.
Yeah, well.
So I scheduled this knowing there would be bagels and lox, knowing I wouldn't be there.
Okay, well,
it was tough.
Are you declaring your sacrifice? Is that just you saying, hey, you know, I'm going to Slovakia to see my fiance, but maybe I'll stay if I can get some fish for free.
You can put them aside for me, right?
Yeah, sure. We'll take care of that. A little later in the show, Malik Rahim, Black Panther veteran and New Orleans resident, joins us in the studio to discuss some of the ongoing relief efforts in New Orleans. We've also got some pretty exciting news revolving around the vice president of the United States. If you haven't heard, he seems to be the source of all of the leaks that came out of the White House and revolving around the Valerie Plame case, though when he said it may not have been a leak because he had security clearance, but whether or not he was involved in a conspiracy, that's still up for grabs whether that indictment will come through. But clearly, all of that was a big propaganda think tank over there, the White House Iraq Group, to propagate the lies that took the country into the war in Iraq. Also, when we come back, we will be talking a little bit about Patrick Fitzgerald himself.
Yeah.
And as I said, we have the Liberal Confessional, so stick around. It's now 57 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
Sedition on Air America Radio.
That's right, it's 6 past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's the Morning Sedition program here on Air America Radio. I hope you're having a decent Tuesday morning. Folks, a grim milestone has been hit. It has been reported on CNN, on the television and in print, that 2,000 American military personnel have been killed since the beginning of the Iraq conflict. 2,000 dead Americans since George Bush and Dick Cheney took us into this war based on lies. According to the New York Times today, notes of Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose identity is the heart of the leak investigation, from Dick Cheney, folks.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned it weeks before her identity became public in July 2003. There was a conversation between Libby and Cheney on June 12, 2003. This means that certainly Libby perjured himself because he told the grand jury that he had heard it from journalists. It might mean that Cheney lied to Fitzgerald as well under oath last year. What this means for, you know, how broad the conspiracy is and what is going to be prosecuted and what he can be prosecuted, who knows? Indictments are forthcoming. We're expecting them any day now. Now, look, I just want you to get a heads up on this. The White House is intending to pursue a strategy of attacking and any criminal charges that are handed down by the federal prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald. They are going to try to slander this guy, Riley. They're going to try to do it. They're going to say that he's overzealous. They're going to say that the crimes are minimal and that they're not really crimes. They're just politics. They will try to minimize and dismiss anything he says. But the bottom line is, you can't really dismiss this guy. This guy is a solid prosecutor. Patrick Fitzgerald is a classic federal prosecutor, like Elliot Ness is. Guy. I mean, this is how are they going to try? Are they going to say he's overzealous when he went after the Gambino crime family, or when he went after Osama bin Laden for the 1998 African embassy bombings? I don't know how he didn't connect Bush to that, but or at least the Bush family somehow. I mean, bin Laden and their family, the business, the construction business, and the George H.W. and the Carlyle Group. Come on, wake up, people. How clear does it have to be? The Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman was prosecuted by you know, Patrick Fitzgerald for the 1993 World Trade Center attack. This guy's a straight shooter.
Yeah, he is a straight shooter, and he's not going to be easily smeared by the people that may or may not get indicted in this case. It looks like, at this point, Mark, no one is doubting that indictments are coming. The question is who and how wide is the scope of the criminality that Patrick Fitzgerald found here.
Well, it can be assumed that that Fitzgerald has expanded his probe to include intelligence information. You know, as even according to Raw Story and your guy, Raimondo, and what's the name of that website?
Antiwar.com.
That it looks like, and also this has been validated by United International Press. On Monday, the Fitzgerald's investigators have sought and obtained documentation on the Italian forgeries that represent transactions between Niger and Iraq in terms of acquiring this uranium, but they've been proven to be false. It's not sure who did the forgeries, but if he's looking into that stuff, that really widens the investigation.
It widens the investigation. Let me tell you something. This whole Niger forgery thing is some dirty, dirty business. It involves a burglary that goes back several years. It involves the alleged theft of stationery, because when they got into the burglary, all they found was a watch had been burgled and, uh-huh, and some stationery.
Uh-huh.
And there's some questions, and it also involves someone selling these documents at one point to Italian officials. It's just a really, really dirty, murky business. And hopefully Patrick Fitzgerald has been able to sort this out. And if it turns out, we don't know this yet, but if it turns out that Americans were somehow involved in this, they will have violated the law, and they might end up going to jail for it.
For like 5 years on these counts.
5 years on these counts if they knowingly falsified these documents.
And, well, this is it's still a lot of speculation going on. You know, there's people on the blog, on the email, that are sort of like, they'll never get Cheney because they're not going to be able to indict him for whatever reason. We can only speculate, but we will. These indictments are going to come down. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen in the next 2 days. And it, you know, and whatever did happen, you can pretty much assume that the focus of it is going to be around that White House Iraq group. The focus of it's going to be around Dick Cheney's office. It's going to be around Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, perhaps. I don't know if Andrew Card is going to be implicated in this. It could go, you know, all the way to Ari Fleischer, Mary Matlin. It could go to this guy, what's his name, John Wormser?
David Wormser,
yeah. The neocon ideologue who was part of Dick Cheney's staff on loan from John Bolton's office. He was a Middle East advisor, and he's one of the guys that flipped and gave the prosecutor some information about what went on.
We are seeing here, and see, even, let's say for the sake of argument, nobody gets indicted here. What we do have...
God, would that be so disappointing?
No, let me tell you something. Right. What we do have here is a complete and utter indictment of the President of the United States. These are his underlings. These are his employees. And they, if, you know, let's say for the sake of argument, he's blameless, didn't know about any of this.
He still has to take
it. His people put all this together for the purpose of leading him to lead this country into war? What kind of bumbling incompetent, what kind of idiot would have people under him doing this and he not know about it?
Well, that's true. And like, I just want to make that clear from where I'm standing, that even if he didn't know about it, who cares? He's going down. He should go down.
He should go down.
He should probably be impeached, I would say. I mean, if this was some other time in the history of this country, these guys would be guilty of treason. They might be guilty of espionage. Certainly some of them are guilty of perjury. But the bottom line is that all this effort going into protecting Dick Cheney does go to prove that, you know, whether or not Bush didn't know anything or not, I'm sure he knew something, but he is walking around acting all Nixon-y, you know, sort of snapping occasionally, apparently, you know, yelling about Andrew Carter, Dick Cheney, or Karl Rove, going behind his back, not keeping him in the loop. Well, this does go to show who's really running this country.
Well, yeah, and, you know, we should not underestimate George W. Bush snapping at Dick Cheney. When was the last time you heard that happen?
Yeah, well, I think he probably feels betrayed and screwed over somehow. I mean, he doesn't see himself as the puppet that he is.
Well, he sees himself apparently as blameless, if that article in yesterday's Daily News is to be believed. He is, you know, dispersing blame to everyone, but not taking any weight himself. Yo, you presided over this nonsense, you fool.
That's right. Hey, it's not always being easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time. maybe not.
Maybe not.
All right. So we'll get to that in just a second. Look, I would like to continue talking. Let's talk. Let's shift gears here.
Wait a minute. Hold it. Let's go in reverse quick.
All right. Let's do this now. It's not always be easy being an herbal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but we need to unburden ourselves. We can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned, my friend.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, I just keep seeing Tom DeLay in my mind.
Well, yes, that's disturbing.
And he's smiling. Why is that guy smiling, Brother Riley? He's been indicted, for God's sakes, but he's still the same old belligerent, arrogant, control freak he's always been.
I know, he's shameless.
He's bullying and smug and completely oblivious to criticism.
Yeah, he's some piece of work.
And you know what else?
What's that?
It's fantastic, Riley. I think everything Tom DeLay stands for is completely repellent. But God, look at him. He just stands there and fires right back at us, even when he's posing for his mugshot. His mugshot, Riley. What incredible, gigantic nads this guy has.
Do you really admire someone who abuses their power like he has?
Yes. Yes, I'm tired of losing. I'm tired of whining. I'm tired of apologizing and all that crap. I want to run roughshod over everyone like he does. Why can't I be the progressive hammer?
Because hammer is wrong, and you know that.
So, look how committed he is. Tom DeLay actually believes the stuff that comes out of his mouth, and he's not ashamed of it. He doesn't question it, and he's going to keep at you until you believe it, too.
That doesn't mean they're right.
No, I know, but guys like him just keep coming at you, and they just keep coming until you get to a point where they drain you, and, you know, all you want to do is take a nap or go see a movie or read a book. It seems like you got two choices, register Republican or lie down and wait for them to roll right over you. We can't win, man. Game over, dude. Game
over. You seem to be experiencing a serious crisis of faith here, Mark. Luckily, there's someone I can call when special cases like this come up. There's someone who wants to talk to you.
All right, but there's no one who can help me now.
Hey, Mark.
Bill Clinton, is that you?
Hey, yeah, buddy. You're kind of bumming me out a little bit. What's with all the negativity, man?
I'm sorry, Mr. President.
Hey, it's okay, man. We all get down sometimes. The hammer's more bark than bite anyway. Don't ever forget that. And we got elections coming up, too. Hey, you know what I'm saying? Elections?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Hey, we need you, Mark. Okay. Don't give up on us, buddy. Okay. We'll all be smiling soon enough. Hang in there, baby. I'm going to talk to you soon. You're the best.
Wow. Well, thank you, Brother Riley. I needed that. As usual, Clinton's right. What was I thinking, man?
You have to remember, it's not just you. We're all in this together.
Yeah.
Now go forth and sin no more.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Riley. Wow. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. 2270. We'll take your confessions in a moment. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In just a few minutes, we're going to have Malik Rahim on. He is a ex-Black Panther and a New Orleans resident. He's going to join us in the studio to discuss the ongoing relief efforts in New Orleans. Right now, we're taking confessions on the phone, 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Let's go to Keith, listening here in New York City to WLIB. Keith, what is your confession?
Hey, Keith.
Hi, Brother Mark.
Yeah,
Brother
wow.
Mark. Hi, this is pretty bad.
Your heart sounds heavy, my son.
My name may or may not be Keith, but
okay.
I have to be kind of anonymous. I teach in a local medical school here, and which name should remain anonymous. It
mm-hmm.
may or may not start with a C and end with an A.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a resident that I've been supervising, and I've been nice to him.
Yeah. That doesn't sound so bad yet.
He's Roger Ailes' son-in-law.
Oh, my God. And you've been nice to him?
Well, I did get him the George Packer piece out of the New Yorker, but...
Yeah,
I mean, I'm supposed to teach these guys. They're going to be future doctors, and I...
What kind of student is he? Let's be honest.
Well, he's a good resident, I guess. I mean, I did tell the other resident that he looked like a Ken doll.
Well, that's good. That's good. So you're starting a little slander
campaign.
But now,
is he really that tight with his in-laws? What do you think?
Yeah, actually, when I first met him, he had just come from a barbecue over at Roger Ailes' house.
Oh, that's tight.
Really? Were they barbecuing a Democrat?
Yeah, I think it was kittens.
Yeah, I hear they do that. Those Ailes, the Ailes family eats kittens. I think that there's only one thing to do is, to secretly continue along the slander campaign that you've already started. Does he look like a Ken doll?
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways you can go. Maybe you start dropping hints that he's not going to be a good doctor. That perhaps that he father of a black baby out of wedlock's always good.
I can Carl Rove him.
Sure, his in-law is one of the guys that taught Carl Rove how to do it. I think that you should. And then if worse comes to worse, maybe you should teach him a special medical technique. You know what I'm saying?
One of those special medical...
Pull him aside and give him the... Well, here's a couple of tips that a lot of people don't know about performing this particular medical technique. I'm not saying to plant seeds for perhaps future malpractice suits, which are going to be harder to bring against doctors who do that because of Republican legislation, but I don't think that's out of bounds.
I think that that's a good plan. I feel better already.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Keith. I'm glad we could help out.
Thanks Keith.
So much.
Wow. Yes.
Mark, up next we got Carl from Asheville, North Carolina. He's got a confession he wants to give to you.
Carl, what's your confession, Carl?
Hey, Carl.
Well, I'm a lifelong Democrat. My wife, I married 17 years ago, is a lifelong Republican, and that's in and of itself is
difficult.
Bad, but
yeah.
We were trying to spice things up a little bit, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
So I asked her if she wouldn't mind dressing up occasionally like Ann Coulter. that was pretty good for a while. I was kind of having my way with her, so to speak. She was a nice little blonde wench. But then she asked me would I mind dressing up like John Edwards.
Uh-huh.
And things really got out of hand. She turned mean on me.
So
the stuff started hurting a little bit, and the password wasn't working much anymore.
Oh my goodness!
So I got all these strange marks I got to explain at work to the guys, and I'm running out of ideas.
Oh, Lord. So
what do I do?
I'm just trying to figure out which sin do we address?
Yeah, man.
Well, I
was in your town this past weekend.
In boiling oil or something.
I don't know.
What's that?
Should I just go ahead and jump in a big vat of boiling oil and get it over with?
Well, no, it seems that I think what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to go back in there with the John Edwards the hair on and maybe put on some chaps and a leather jacket and then show her who's boss.
Yeah.
I think that you should, no matter how good it feels, after a certain point, if the password's not working and Ann Coulter, your wife is dressed as Ann Coulter and she's beating you up, I think it's time.
Boy.
You got to teach her a lesson. Carl, that's all there is to it. You can't take this anymore. You got to teach her a lesson wearing a... You know what? Why don't you do a John Kerry outfit in fatigues and teach Ann Coulter a lesson?
Yeah.
How's that?
Tell your wife you're reporting for duty.
Yes.
Maybe there's a way out of this.
Yeah.
I'll be the Swift veteran.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, buddy. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks for calling.
Glad we could help you out.
I told you those folks in
you. You bet. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's folks in Asheville are different, I'll tell you that. I found that out this past weekend.
Well, thank you for all your confessions, all two of them. That was exciting, and those were good ones. And
that was my personal favorite confession in the history of our liberal confessionals.
Well, I think that we saved him. I think that he's going to go out and get himself some secondhand army outfit.
But I think there's some underlying anger issues there, guys. I mean, this is his wife who he loves, and so to spice things up, he had her dress up as someone that he hates, Ann Coulter.
No, I don't know. I think that somehow or another sex is difficult to understand. But I think that maybe he's got to stop being the victim and stand up for himself.
There you go.
It's 27 past the hour. In a few seconds or a few minutes even, we're going to be talking to Malik Rahim, Black Panther veteran, And he's doing some work down in New Orleans to help the relief efforts. He's going to tell us what's going on down there. So stay with us for that. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In a couple of minutes, we'll be talking to Malik Rahim, Black Panther veteran and a New Orleans resident. He's going to join us in the studio to discuss the ongoing relief efforts in New Orleans. That's one of those things that sort of, you know, faded away from the news pretty quickly. It was a great, horrendous portal into poverty in this country, a great opportunity for Democratic leaders to seize a position and start to really kind of, you know, take hold of some leadership possibilities in relationship to that tragic that storm. And of course, within 2 weeks, nothing.
Well, of course, because what you have is the Bush administration holding up some money, and you have the cameras have been turned off, the Klieg lights have been turned off, people have moved away from New Orleans.
Yeah, and now there's a lot of money going into rebuilding it and making contracts with cronies of the Bush administration. A lot of that money that's being funneled through the state is going to go right into the pockets of contractors, and they've been able to really push away any sort of hiring of people that even live there because they've suspended that, they've repealed the Bacon-Davis that would enable them to pay them minimum wage, and they've also suspended affirmative action hiring ruling, so now they can just bring in, you know, very cheap help. It's a disaster, and hopefully Malik Rahim will have some hope in telling us what he's doing down there. A couple of things I want to share with you. A grim milestone hit today. 2,000 U.S. military personnel dead in Iraq since the invasion. This was something we've been moving towards, and today is the day that this horrendous milestone has been hit. 2,000 people, military personnel killed, Riley, since the beginning.
This is the thing that the Bush administration has dreaded almost as much as the end of the Fitzgerald grand jury. The idea that there would be 2,000 deaths, he knows it will be widely publicized at a time when support for the war is at an historic low.
And also, it's important that right alongside of that, we know where the leak started. The leak that revealed the lies that caused the death of 2,000 military personnel from this country started, according to the New York Times today, notes of Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, show that he learned about the CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose identity is the heart of the leak investigation, from Dick Cheney. Weeks before her identity became public in July 2003, there was a conversation between Libby and Cheney on June 12, 2003. This means that Libby certainly perjured himself because he told the grand jury that he heard it from journalists. It might mean that Cheney lied to Fitzgerald under oath last year. Time will tell. But this, of course, is the bottom line, is that Cheney and his neocon cohorts put the White House Iraq group together to dupe the American people with skewed intelligence into going into a war that was based on lies and has made the world a more dangerous place and has now killed 2,000 American soldiers and thousands of Iraqi civilians. The crime is compromising national security by leaking the name of a covert agent as a reprisal against someone exposing those lies that they were trying to sell to the American people to go into a war that was certainly unnecessary.
Absolutely.
It seems that our guest is on his way to the microphone.
There you go.
He's putting on his headset. He's sitting down. Let's go ahead and introduce him. Our next guest is a former Black Panther who rode out Hurricane Katrina in the Algiers section of New Orleans. Since then, he has refused to sit back and watch profiteers take over his city. He's co-founded Common Ground Relief, an organization that provides everything from medical support to clean up for the residents of New Orleans. Malik Rahim joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Malik.
Good morning.
Thank you so much.
And I'm sorry for being a little late.
Oh, we didn't even tell anybody you were late. But thank you for
bothering. Glad you're here.
You're
man.
Right on time as far
all
as
right,
I could tell.
All right.
So we were just talking about how the Bush administration has really made it almost impossible for, I think, local residents to even be part of the reconstruction of their own city and be paid for it and also feel like they are rebuilding their neighborhood. What's going on down there in relation to that?
Well, in relation to it, it's just pure chaos.
Yeah.
We have avaricious businessmen that's coming in from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get some of these lucrative contracts.
Tell us about your organization. What's it called, and how did development come about?
Well, Common Ground is a direct result of the relief effort that we started on day three.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, in a little bit over, just about 2 months, we have served over 16,000 people.
Oh, yeah, and what kind of services do you provide there?
We started with a health clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We started with a first aid station. Now we have a full-functioning health clinic.
Oh, great.
In which we have served over 3,100 people at our health clinic, providing everything from prenatal care to inoculation shots for hepatitis and just about everything.
Oh, that's
and
good.
And then
that's
we have
good.
A mobile clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We have a mobile clinic that we go out into some of the surrounding areas, still providing services, because in a lot of the remote areas, there's no health care.
Mm-hmm.
So between our stationary clinic at the mosque that we use and our mobile health clinic, we serve on average of close to 300 people a day.
Great.
Wow. Malik Rahim, are black folks getting jobs down there? I mean, we've heard about the affirmative action being suspended. We know black people have been catching hell down there, but have they been getting any work in the rebuilding of New Orleans?
Now, that's a tricky question. It's called what you call black people, you know, because New Orleans is an area that is based upon class and race.
Race, yes, true.
And you have many that is Creoles that call themselves black when it's black is beautiful. Black is beautiful when there's money involved. So you have some people that...
Isn't it always like that?
Oh, yes. So, what I've noticed is that only those with political connection, whether they're white or black, is the one that's truly capitalizing on the rebuilding.
Connections to the mayor? To the governor?
To the mayor, the governor, and the president.
Incredible.
And it's just like that. The bigger contracts, the more connections you have. The less a contract, the less connection you have.
Mm-hmm.
But what you find is that those that was always out of the economic market is still out of it. You had areas where unemployment was almost 85%.
Areas of New Orleans before
yes.
Katrina.
Before Katrina.
Incredible.
And with those areas, you know, they are not talking about establishing training programs. They're bringing in undocumented immigrants and depitting them against the poor blacks in these communities for the most hazardous jobs.
The lowest paid jobs.
Yes, and the most hazardous.
Incredible.
You know, what I'm talking about is removing mold infestation. So you have this kind of jobs that is offered. Most of the roofing work is being carried out by undocumented immigrants.
See, that's interesting because that's directly in response to that the Bacon and Davis Act.
The Davis-Bacon Act.
Yeah. Oh, the Davis-Bacon Act.
If you want to see what was the outcome of repealing it,
mm-hmm.
please come to New Orleans.
Well, I hear
on
it in
a
your
naval
voice.
Base,
mm-hmm.
on a United States naval base in Algiers, we saw at least 10 busloads of undocumented immigrants going in there doing the work. And the saddest part about it is that they have them living in tents.
So they're exploiting them.
Oh, yes, they're exploiting them. They are living in tents.
Wow.
While the white and so-called American workers is living in buildings.
Incredible. Malik Rahim, you were a former Black Panther.
Yes.
I go back far enough to know that the Black Panther Party
was
not...
So you go back way further than that.
Well, I go back far enough to know that it wasn't just a, quote, militant nationalist organization. You had free breakfast programs, you had health clinics. How did your work as a Panther inform your work now?
Oh, listen, there's nowhere in the world I would be able to do the work that I'm doing now if it wasn't for the fact of the work I did in the Panther Party. The food program that we are doing now is a direct result. The health clinic, our mold abatement program is a direct result of us doing our pest control program. Our closing program is one that we did in the Panther Party. Our food distribution is one that I learned while I was a member of the Panther Party. So just about all the training I received then, you know, I'm able to carry it out now. I always wondered what I was being trained for.
Now you know.
I'm just sorry that I had to become an old man before I realized.
But you're not too old to run for office, and you recently ran for New Orleans City Council. Are you going to run again?
Yes, I am.
Well, that's great, man.
And but not for City Council.
What are you running for?
Congress?
Oh, no, I'm going to run for mayor of New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right.
So does Ray Nagin know about this?
He know about it now.
I hope he's listening now.
Absolutely. You didn't think he did a great job, did you?
I think he did a horrible job. I believe he dropped the ball. See, New Orleans is a city that ever since it became a black majority, that plantation syndicate have always tried to take the city back. And he literally threw it in their hands. When the hurricane hit, we had 3 days prior to us coming to New Orleans to get everybody out of harm's way.
Didn't happen.
Didn't happen. We didn't remove anyone. His only thing was at the last minute, put him in a Superdome. And we are talking about 120 to 150,000 poor people at the end of the month. People who average income is roughly between $6,000 and $8,000 a year.
$6,000 and $8,000 a year.
A year. And so he knew they couldn't get out of harm's way. They provided no food, no water, no blankets, nothing.
Tell me the phrase plantation syndicate. What does that cover?
Well, basically, New Orleans is a city that's still ran by old money.
Right.
And anything that's new, anything that's innovative, they don't care because the French Quarter's gonna always make money,
right?
You know, so that old money is the dominant money, and that's based upon a slave mentality.
Wow!
And that slave mentality means you only give a slave enough to survive, not enough to excel. So that's why you have in New Orleans that when the schools was integrated, New Orleans went from having some of the best public schools to the worst. That's why you have individuals in New Orleans. You look at the parks. You know, New Orleans is the only city with an NFL football team that where kids learn to play that sport. They're uninsured.
What?
That's right. They're uninsured. A person would have to sign a waiver.
Yeah.
Against suing the city if their kids get injured. You know, in New Orleans. And you find that we'll spend $90,000 a year to keep a child incarcerated, but we won't even spend $90,000 a year on an entire neighborhood to make sure that there's recreation program. So it has always been based upon. We passed a living wage amendment to raise the minimum wage from $5.15 to $6.15. It has been tied up in litigation ever since 2002.
Wow.
And that's by those that plantation
syndicate. I like that. The plantation syndicate is a great way to put it. You know, I saw it. Just out of curiosity, I was watching Bill Maher's show the other night, and Spike Lee was a guest, and he's doing a documentary on Katrina, and he seems to be talking a little bit about this this theory that that there were maybe explosive devices in the levees. Is there is that spreading throughout the community, that story, and what do you think about that?
It always been that theory ever since Bessie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hurricane Bessie, they said that that was in 1965, that the levee was, they exploded the levee in order to save downtown. I believe it wasn't exploded, it was imploded.
Yeah.
And the implosion was caused by greed, corruption,
right,
and racism.
Mm-hmm. Republican policy, in other words.
Well, not only Republican right. policy, because... You know, in Louisiana, there have always been a thing that people thought it was a little joke about the corruption. Because, see, every year, the federal government give billions of dollars to Louisiana through the Pelican Commission for the restoration of the wetlands and the restore and the rebuild our levee system.
Right.
And it's ironic that the only levees that broke was the ones that protect working class and poor people.
Unbelievable.
You know, I believe that speaks for itself.
It sure plantation syndicate negligence on purpose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, well, it's great to have you here, and thank you for joining us. Is there any way that people can get involved? Anything I can tell the people? You got
please, we are doing a campaign, a caravan, a campaign for Thanksgiving. We're asking for people to come down to New Orleans, people of conscience, to come down to help us with the rebuilding, to come spend the first holiday since Katrina in New Orleans with us for Thanksgiving weekend. We're asking people to come from the 20th to the 27th.
Oh, there you go.
They could get in touch with us by going to our website, and that's commongroundrelief.org, or by calling us at area code 504-368-6897, or by writing us at 331 Atlantic Avenue, New Orleans, Louisiana, 70114. Get involved.
Great.
Because if people of conscience don't stand up now, then New Orleans going to probably be rebuilt, but it's going to be a city only for the rich and the prosperous.
That's a deep invitation from our guest, Malik Rahim. Thank you so much for joining us.
And we'll put
that information on our website and get that out there. Appreciate you coming.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. It's 50 past the hour. We'll be back with some closing comments, some thoughts, and all, of course, Cliff Notes. So stay with us, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
All right, it's 54 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Tradition program. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley. Put this thing down here. Look, folks, next week, Morning's Edition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant for another live broadcast. That's next Thursday, November 3rd. Come on down. That's at 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West. If you're out of town, you know, I got an email from some guy yesterday, a fan of the show, all pissed off. It's like, you know, in the last half hour, it seems like all you guys do is New York stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, buddy. This is an invitation to you. Come on, fly on up.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make this local. You can fly from anywhere in the country to come see us at O'Neill's. And we, and, you know, you laugh, but you know, Riley, you got people that come up like I got, some guy flew out from where was it? Madison, Wisconsin?
Madison, Wisconsin, Minnesota, California. We've had people who drove down from Connecticut and Massachusetts.
They're coming up.
Yep.
You know, they come. So this is a pretty much a nationwide, international even, reach out to have someone come on by and, you know, and see the show. It's going to be a good show. We're going to have James Walcott on. Lisa Lampanelli, the extremely offensive comedian, will be there. Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. right now, folks, and thank you for joining us. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. A Freedom of Information lawsuit has revealed documents that show the FBI has conducted surveillance on U.S. residents without proper authority or oversight. The FBI said none of the cases involve major violations as far as anyone living can testify. The FBI records were turned over after a Freedom of Information lawsuit by a privacy advocacy group whose leader, the FBI noted, makes frequent trips to an adult bookstore and one stint to the parked car without leaving a note. Man, a lot of words. A new McDonald's ad campaign is focusing on the quality of McDonald's food and the company's safety practices. In a somewhat similar campaign, Arby's is trying to lure people into their restaurant by promising to never, ever reveal what goes into their food. Before the meat is allowed to be unloaded at the plant to protect against E. coli, the security guard is required to ask the driver of the meat truck, is this stuff okay? All right. The Cleveland father, who was accused of keeping adopted special needs kids in cages, is saying he did it for their safety. The children were removed from the home last month and sent to foster homes with more upscale cages. The father said that not only were the cage kids fed regular meals, but that visitors could buy peanuts to toss at them. Privately, the father asked, quote, do you know how much more it costs to raise free-range children? All right, here we go. Phrase of the day, folks. Phrase of the day. Just drop it into conversation. Does anyone care that the FBI is listening in on your conversations anymore? You can't go 5 feet without hearing someone spew out every detail of their pathetic lives into a cell phone. Wake up, sheeple. No one cares about privacy anymore, no matter how much we bitch about it. If you're tired of people listening to you, then start shutting the up in public for 5 minutes. How would that be? All right. What do we got tomorrow, Riley?
Tomorrow we've got Dr. Andrew Weil. He'll be joining us in studio to talk about healthy aging, a subject near and dear to my heart. And Lawton Smalls comes back from vacation, Marin.
All right, man.
It's been fun.
Has been.
See you tomorrow here on Air America Radio.